Well, it's a distinct honor and privilege to introduce a friend and a mentor, Dr. Nazli Laghani. I think the last time I had an opportunity to introduce Naz was in Oxford, maybe 6 years ago or so. So in Naz's hometown, Dr. Ghani's hometown. So now I have the opportunity to welcome her to Canada. So welcome. Dr. Ghani teaches international human rights law at the University of Oxford, and is a member of the OSCE Panel of Experts on Freedom of Religion or Belief, from whose meeting she came here from, I believe. She's founding editor of the International Journal of Religion and Human Rights, and now serves on the editorial board of the Oxford Journal of Law and Religion. Her research interests include freedom of religion and belief, minority rights, the intersection between freedom of expression and freedom of religion or belief, non-discrimination and equality, and human rights in the Middle East. And not only is she accomplished academically, she's one of those rare breed that is actively engaged in policy discussions. Earlier this year, she was the head of a research team investigating religion and belief, discrimination and equality in England and Wales, from which a forthcoming monograph will be appearing later on this year. Her publications include 9 books, 4 UN publications, and a number of journal articles and reports. Among the most prominent are Religious Minorities Really Minorities, Preaching and Practicing Freedom of Religion or Belief in the Commonwealth, and Human Rights, the UN, and the Baha'is of Iran. So please welcome Dr. Naz Ghani.
Thank you very much. Jeff, I seem to follow in your footsteps, so you welcomed me to Oxford before I got a job there, and it's great to be here. Thank you very much for this kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I came 2 days earlier, and I've enjoyed McGill in the sunshine. In fact, I'm so excited. I want my daughter to study here. And just like all pushy Iranian mums, she's only 10, but I've already decided that for her. Unfortunately, I'm not sure she's a religious studies student. At the moment, she loves literature, but we'll work on that. I've got a few years. It's an honor to be here. There have been very distinguished speakers in the morning, and I have a modest goal this afternoon, and that is to bring to bear more specifically what the normative contribution of international human rights law is to this area. And what I want to do is to look on the one hand at minority rights provisions in international human rights law, and then go to the freedom of religion or belief normative standards. And the reason is that we normally do it the opposite way around. We think religious minorities, freedom of religion or belief, and that umbrella and those standards are sufficient for them. Brian and I were fortunate enough to be in the first seminar ever that the UN held 14 months ago that examined the question of religious minorities specifically as minorities. So what has happened over the last 6.5 decades at the UN is that although whenever there's reference made to minorities, we often use the terms ethnic, religious, and linguistic, nevertheless, when you look at where the claims go and which mandates pick up the issues, religious minority issues have been dealt with under freedom of religion or belief rather than minority rights. And it's only in the last 14 months that the specific issue of religious minorities is being considered more fully within the minority framework. So I'm not saying the UN did nothing for religious minorities. I'm just saying that the primary lens through which the question was examined was freedom of religion or belief. And there are good reasons for that. But I want to suggest that the minority rights framework also offers specific added value for religious minorities. For many religious minorities. Now, the whole point about minority rights is the understanding that equality alone is insufficient where we have different starting points. I think we understood this in terms of women's rights more than 3 decades ago, that treating unequal people equally and expecting them to elevate themselves in the ranks doesn't work. It's actually a discrimination. And therefore, the idea of minority rights as understood within the international human rights framework is that special rights are required in order to actually deliver on an equal platform and an equal playing field. So in order to put them on an equal playing field, you need to allow special rights to minorities. So when we look at the international human rights framework, then what are the understandings that we have regarding minority rights? Well, first of all, a definition. There isn't a single internationally agreed definition of minorities, okay, that states have agreed to in a binding instrument. Nevertheless, there are definitions that everybody uses as the starting point for discussion, and I think they're helpful to us. So one of these is the definition given by Capitorti. He was a sub-commission expert who came up with a report on a study on minorities back in 1977. He says that a minority is a group numerically inferior to the rest of the population of a state in a non-dominant position whose members, being nationals of the state, possess ethnic, religious, or linguistic characteristics differing from those of the rest of the population, and show, if only implicitly, a sense of solidarity directed towards preserving their culture, tradition, religion, or language. So I think the word inferior is an unfortunate one, but it's numerically inferior. So they're numerically a minority, but that's only the first condition. There are other requirements for the definition of minority. Also, the numerical inferiority is in relation to the whole of the state, and I have a problem with this because I think when we look at the question of religious minorities, surely, if we're looking at the grassroots, we're looking at particular communities and particular questions or tensions, we have to also look even at the question of minority in a particular locality, let alone, a province or a state or a region or whatever. But that's already one question there. The second characteristic is that they're in a non-dominant position. Okay, so Bashar al-Assad is not a minority because he's in a dominant position in Syria. The point of minority rights within a human rights framework is not to strengthen minorities that are already in power and possibly suppressing a majority, but regardless of that, it's not to give special rights to the al-Assad family, for example, or other minorities who are in power. Okay, so they're numerically inferior and in a non-dominant position. They possess characteristics, but the possession of those characteristics is not enough. They possess characteristics that they themselves show a solidarity for maintaining. So this isn't an anthropological project of preserving languages. That may have its own moral duty or whatever, but within human rights law, this isn't about saving languages or ethnic groups or religious minorities even. We might be sad if a religious minority group ceases to exist, okay? But human rights is not about going out and saving them and rescuing them, okay? So the group itself has characteristics that it shows that it wants to continue. And it's only then that human rights kicks in, okay? Is that clear, or is that, maybe it's a bit too self-evident? But the sense of solidarity comes from then. The standard that we have in a binding instrument is Article 27 of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. So our definition is numerically inferior, non-dominant, possess characteristics that they themselves want to maintain. Okay? So with these persons, what rights do they have? Well, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights says that in those states in which ethnic, religious, or linguistic minorities exist, persons belonging to such minorities shall not be denied the right, in community with the other members of their group, to enjoy their own language, to profess and practice their own religion, or to enjoy their own culture, to profess and practice their own religion, and to use their own language. So the rights holders, as the ambassador told us this morning and said earlier, the rights holders are persons. the rights holders are not the language, and they're not the religion, and they're not the ethnic group. They're not the ethnicity, rather. Okay? So the persons have these rights to, in community with others, and this is what distinguishes what is clearer within minority rights than in freedom of religion or belief itself, is that it's in community with others. Minority rights is necessarily in community with others. Freedom of religion or belief is often in community with others, but not necessarily. Okay? So they have the right to enjoy their own language, culture, and religion. And I would say that all of these apply to religious minorities. It's not only that ethnic groups enjoy culture, linguistic groups enjoy language, and religious groups enjoy religion. I think if we look at the reality on the ground, many religious minorities may also have their own language. And certainly, they have their own culture. They have a religious culture that may be also mixed with other characteristics and aspects. Okay? So these are we have the definition, and we have this right that is upheld in the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, and therefore which the majority of states have voluntarily entered into a binding commitment to uphold Article 27. So there are certain characteristics that I think are more pronounced in minority rights regime than in freedom of religion or belief. Firstly, it is very clear within the minority rights regime that the existence of a minority group needs to be objectively determined. Okay? As the Human Rights Committee has said, the existence of an ethnic, religious, or linguistic minority in a given state party does not depend upon a decision by that state party, but requires to be established by objective criteria. I think this is tremendously useful because especially where there is a state religion or ideology religion relationship, then of course the temptation is there for the state to say, we don't recognize them as a religion, therefore they're not a religious minority, therefore they neither have freedom of religion or belief, nor do they have minority rights. Easy, simple, throw it out of the door. Okay? Now, minority rights emphasizes, because the whole minority experience necessitates this, it emphasizes that there must be objective determination. The first criteria that human rights law will always use is self-definition, okay? But again, that's not the only definition. So self-definition, that solidarity to maintain a characteristic, that is a strong foundation. What the state recognizes or not is not our guide. Secondly, minority rights emphasizes that the group shares particular characteristics that it wishes to maintain. Okay, these are persons who belong to a group and who share in common a culture, a religion, or a language. It is not purely, exclusively individualistic. And the temptation has been, you know, if I was going to be very simplistic, I would divide the world into two blocks. One block has experience with minority rights of categorizing people and grouping them and delivering rights to those groups. That is problematic, and I'll return to that. That is problematic because it's rigid, and, you know, I think perhaps it worked over 100 years ago, but I don't think it's workable anymore. Secondly, we have groups that don't have that historical opportunity and burden, but they think that religion or belief is necessarily private, individualized, and doesn't need to be entertained in the public sphere. That too is problematic. So I think this shows that religious minorities don't fit easily into either of these experiences. Effective participation. A key criteria of the minority rights regime is that minorities should be able to effectively participate, not only in decisions that concern them, but also they should be able to participate fully in the economic progress and the development of their country. So they shouldn't be ghettoized, excuse the words, because of historical burden, but, you know, they shouldn't be separated out and be put in a corner and be given rights in that corner, okay? Effective participation in decisions that concern them, well, for religious minorities, it would at least be matters of practice and teaching and manifestation. It would at least be those, but I think we have to take them fairly expansively. But it's not only that. We can't just give them those rights. Effective participation is also in public life, in culture, in the decisions of the nation as a whole. Full participation in the economic progress and development of their country. By the way, these are all words from the international standards, so either from Article 27 or the general comment that interprets that by the Human Rights Committee. And the aim of this effective participation is in order to promote mutual understanding and confidence. So the benefits of effective participation by minorities is not only for minorities, it's for the public at large, it's for wider society. I think there was this morning several people spoke about the enrichment of society as a whole, and that is the benchmark of the minority rights understanding. Another factor in minority rights is that the aim is the survival and continued development of the identity of those minorities. Survival is not static. Again, we don't sort of separate them out and put them in a cage and allow them to survive and perhaps tourists throw nuts at them. I mean, it's not like that. Continued development gives us the idea that, you know, of course the persons belonging to minorities may come, they may go, they may identify, they may not identify. The cultures of those minority groups will constantly change. Just as they enrich wider society may freely also enrich them. So they are not crystallized and fixed cultures. And then it is also clear from the minority rights standards that positive measures may be required, positive measures of protection may be required by the states in favor of minorities. Okay? We never talk in freedom of religion or belief regarding the positive measures required for the continued development of a religious minority. It's just not the language or the criteria or the threshold that we have in mind in freedom of religion or belief. But what I'm saying that is, of course, we are all beneficiaries of all human rights that apply to us. So it's not a choice between minority rights and freedom of religion or belief. But I think these factors that have been outlined suggest that there is much that may benefit religious minorities as minorities as well. Now, returning to freedom of religion or belief, or going back to the more dominant lens that has been used in relation to religious minorities over the past 6.5 decades, freedom of religion or belief, of course, is also applicable and relevant to religious minorities. One of the factors that becomes very clear in the freedom of religion or belief standards, the normative regime, is that the scope of the definition or the scope of religion or belief is very broad indeed. The Human Rights Committee has said that freedom of religion or belief is far-reaching and profound. It encompasses freedom of thought on all matters, personal conviction, and the commitment to religion or belief, whether manifested individually or in community with others. It includes theistic, non-theistic, and atheistic beliefs, as well as the right not to profess any religion or belief. I think it's worth pausing for a moment here that, of course, this was a Cold War compromise to put the words religion and belief together. If we go back to the historical antecedents, then the term has always been religious liberty, not religion and belief liberty. It also leads to clumsy formulations where, you know, we should really be talking about religion or belief minorities, not just religious minorities. But this benefits also the more sort of the narrower understanding of religious minorities, because in states that are theocracies or are whose politics are heavily informed by a particular theology or religious background, it is through the back door of belief that most religious minorities can be catered for. So, although this was a Soviet effort, it was a compromise between East and West, the inclusion of belief benefits the narrower understanding of religion as well. So many minority religions, the state will never have the stomach to recognize them as religious minorities. But when the international standards and requirements are religion and belief, then the state has nowhere to hide. I mean, it obviously is violating Article 18 standards. So the benefits are beyond belief, although of course non-belief and no coercion in maintaining theistic or changing to atheistic beliefs should also be upheld. So that has a value in itself, but it also has a value to religious groups. There should be non-coercion. The ambassador this morning spoke about this. There should be no coercion regarding the absolute aspect of freedom of religion or belief. And the having, the changing, and the adopting of religion or belief is absolute. And there, this can never be violated legitimately or legally. And also, this is there should be no coercion in matters of adopting, changing, or maintaining a religion or belief. Now, there's a we should reflect a lot more on coercion. There are many countries in the world where you cannot marry unless you change your religion or belief, or you cannot marry the person you want to marry. If your husband or wife converts, in some countries you're given a 3-month period of grace to convert or divorce. And this is even referred to as a mercy from the government. I mean, great, the government is there breaking up families on the grounds of one person changing their religion. But it's not only the marriage that the person will lose because their husband or wife has converted. They will also lose marital assets and custody and inheritance. And, you know, there is a very high price that is paid in purely civil matters in many countries. Is this not coercive? Then, of course, there's, you know, death penalty and torture and the more obvious violations, too. In freedom of religion or belief, manifestation of religion or belief is not absolute, okay? It can be limited, but the grounds of limitation are laid out very clearly in the international standards. Such limitations should be prescribed by law, necessary to protect public safety, order, health, or morals, or the fundamental rights and freedoms of others. It is also emphasized that the morals mustn't be from a single tradition. Okay, so it can't be one theological idea of morals being enforced on others to limit their manifestation of religion or belief. It would be pretty bizarre if it was allowed. Also, freedom of religion or belief is given such a high status in international human rights law that it cannot be derogated from, even in times of public emergency. Many rights can be derogated from freedom of religion or belief. Neither the absolute aspect or the manifestation can be derogated from. An interesting part of freedom of religion or belief is that no person should be compelled to reveal their religion or belief. But we know that within the minority policy sphere, if you don't declare, you don't get the benefits. So there's a little bit of a tension there that nobody should be compelled, but it might be that there are minority provisions that require your coming forward before you become a beneficiary. So there's a slight irony there. And although international standards have not forbidden a state religion, I think that we wouldn't have gone far, especially in 1948 and then in 1976, if we had insisted on there that human rights couldn't be upheld if there's a state religion. Nevertheless, and as Brian's slides also suggested, the Human Rights Committee has said that that should not jeopardize or discriminate against others. And Brian's slide suggested that more often than not, where there is a strong affiliation, the chances are that it will lead to discrimination. So that extra vigilance is required where there is a state-religion relationship to ensure that it doesn't lead to discrimination against others. So just in summary, what I've suggested is that the bringing together of both the prisms of minority rights and freedom of religion or belief is beneficial to religious minorities. And that although for decades we have relied exclusively on freedom of religion or belief, and although freedom of religion or belief is also in association with others, or maybe, you know, you're perfectly entitled to have a very private, individualistic religion or belief, but in many instances, the manifestation of religion or belief will be along with others. And freedom of religion or belief allows for that to an extent, but it's more explicitly recognized, that communal dimension is more explicitly recognized within the minority rights regime. And it is to be encouraged that the United Nations is looking more explicitly and sort of welcoming religious minorities back in under the umbrella of the minority rights regime. But of what relevance is that today? I said already that in many parts of the world we have the structures of minority rights that have been used in the past. And unfortunately, you know, whether it's the pillarization system of the Netherlands and Belgium, or whether it's the Ahl al-Kitab or Dhimma system of the Muslim world, or later on that was also expanded in the millet system. The historical rigidity with which we looked at minority rights regime, I don't think is workable or beneficial to religious minorities today. Not only does that get rid of the possibility of self-declaration and change, and you know the fluidity of numbers isn't sufficiently catered for under that reciprocal, you look after my people and I'll look after your people. I mean, human rights also is not about reciprocity. It's about these are birthrights of every individual being from the point of birth, regardless of any trade-offs that may come with agreements that you strike with your neighbors. Okay, so I don't think those historical models are operational anymore. In fact, it's been compounded even further by the securitization of religious minorities over the last 10 years. Also, in countries where the public sphere is not a no-go area for religious minorities, that is also not very beneficial to all of these group rights that we have mentioned. In addition to these difficulties, these historical difficulties, there's also the absolute rejection of the term aghaliya, or minority, in many parts of the world. So in the Middle East, you, at the point of death, you're not going to get any religious minority to declare themselves a minority. It's absolutely rejected, because the implication of saying that you're a minority is that you're not loyal, you're a security risk, that you're not really Egyptian or you're not really Lebanese, that you're foreign. And so it carries a very heavy burden. So the religious minorities themselves are not declaring themselves as religious minorities. Is this really from the religious minorities, or is it because of the high cost that will come from being declared a religious minority or declaring yourself a religious minority? If we go back to the definition of minority within the international human rights regime, then that's not problematic. It's a factual description of non-dominance and numerically inferior and having characteristics that you wish to maintain. But to change the word aghaliya or minority to mean only this and not some kind of tyranny against the government is a problematic obstacle that we need to overcome. This might all seem that I'm sort of celebrating everything there is out there to do with human rights law and the question of religious minorities, and I want to end with a few limitations of the human rights response to religious minorities. First of all, and I'll finish in the next couple of minutes so that we have time for questions and discussion. The first difficulty is that the human rights regime focuses primarily on the duties and responsibilities of state actors. And although that is important, especially where the state itself is the persecutor or the discriminator, that the state resources, ideology, is all used in order to discriminate and perpetuate discrimination against a particular religious minority or minorities, and we have many instances of that. But nevertheless, some of the religious minority questions we face around the world are primarily taken forward by non-state actors. They might, in fact, be religious leaders that are promoting hatred and discrimination against others, and there could be really mob violence and neighborhood revenge in the name of blasphemy, as Brian was suggesting, and other actors and forces. And the human rights regime can only trace those lines of responsibility via the state. And if you're working at the grassroots and you want a quick reaction to solve a sort of evolving tension at the grassroots, then tracing from those actors to who are the state actors, and then when are they next reporting at such and such UN committee, seems quite tedious and slow. I was in a workshop with a Saudi activist 3 weeks ago, and he said, you know, the activists have decided that the UN is just too slow. It's much better to get in touch with Amnesty and the BBC. And that kind of says it all. Secondly, we shouldn't make the status of victimhood distract us from the human rights concerns. Okay? Otherwise, the human rights regime is playing into a sort of political trump card at the local or national level. We may recognize that particular persons are victims of violations, and especially where the perpetrators are state actors, that is massively grave, and we need to continue to draw attention to that at the international level where domestic remedies have proven insufficient, okay? But this isn't, it's not a, we shouldn't sort of play into the religious minority status becoming a trump card and a success, otherwise, you know, a magnet that if we get that status, then we will get the sympathy of the international community, then we will show the government such and such. We should always remember the human rights violations that are at stake so that we're not encouraging everybody to claim persecution. One author has referred to this as oppression Olympics. So what we shouldn't be creating is a religious minority oppression Olympics, that it's a status. Underlying the fact of religious minority status is that violations that may or may not be occurring, if they are occurring, they need to be addressed, they need to get equality before the law, etc., etc. And if not, it shouldn't give, it shouldn't distract from equality. And finally, although our concern and sympathies are naturally drawn towards the minority and victim group, we should also be prepared, or I'm suggesting, this is a slightly risky proposition, but I'm suggesting that we should also give attention to the actions of minority and victim groups themselves. This isn't to say that the minority victim group has an equal responsibility in its plight as the state that is violating them or the non-state actors that are perpetuating hatred and violence against them. I don't want to suggest that at all. But when we're working at the grassroots, the response of the victim minority group is also relevant in the question of how their situation over the long term may be resolved. It's not an either-or position. It's not, well, look at the Copts in northern Egypt, they deserve what they get. This isn't about blame, I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that whilst continuing to draw attention to violations at the international level, our final destination is the resolution of that when the circumstances are right at the domestic level. And in that final resolution, once the time is right and the opportunity is there, the reaction and the strategies, the unity or otherwise, those who represent the religious minority group and their actions are also a relevant factor. And if I was going to propose a way forward for this, it isn't to say that they are complicit in their plight, absolutely not. But it is to say that that too is relevant. And perhaps one of the future seminars that is being held here could be about religious resistance. What forms does that take? How can the oppressed, first of all, not accept a diminished status despite years of discrimination or despite inequality? And secondly, how can we ensure that minorities don't themselves take on the characteristics of the perpetrators of violations against them in the longer term? So that too is important. Maybe the way to take this forward is primarily by insiders within the communities. I know that in the Baha'i community, this is being studied. It's being referred to as constructive resilience of the Baha'i community in Iran after decades, if not over a century, of persecution. But, you know, that too matters, because if you have a minority that has accepted a diminished status, that no longer believes in himself or herself as an equal human being, that is as entitled as the majority or the person in power to be an equal citizen and participate fully and effectively in public life, then even when their situation is resolved thanks to international, regional, and local pressure, even then there will be an empowerment problem to reinstate their full humanity, okay? So it is relevant also to look at how the minority community is surviving, what means of resistance they're using, and this has a longer-term impact. I'll end on that note.
So I think we have time for a couple questions. There's a microphone at the front.
First, I just love the point about non-state actors and minority communities, the strategies that they use in response. I think that's a really crucial issue and deserves more reflection. Secondly, I'm just wondering whether the, there's a hefty debate about religious freedom, definitions of religious freedom, and the communal dimensions of religious freedom. And that often causes some angst in some circles, arguing that a more robust conception of the communal dimensions of religious freedom may end up subverting individual rights. But I'm just wondering whether this approach that you're bringing of in a certain sense, retrieving this discourse on the communal dimensions via minority rights discourse avoids some of the problematic features of a kind of unqualified affirmation of religious freedom as a communal or institutional right.
Yeah. I have a simple answer to that. I mean, I think the human rights regime would definitely say that there is universality, but there's also interdependence. So, you know, human rights will always say, well, all of these rights, the individual dimension, the group dimension, minority rights, freedom of religion or belief, changing and therefore upsetting the sort of upsetting the community, if you like, changing and exiting must always be maintained. Also, freedom of religion or belief coexists alongside the respect of the rights and freedoms of others. And the bottom line, you know, the red line in all rights claims will be when the rights of, and freedoms of others are restricted. I mean, that will be then a limitation. I suppose the risk is that the minority, we shouldn't, I'm also not suggesting, thank you for reminding me, I'm not suggesting that we should subvert freedom of religion or belief and go down the minority routes, because I think the individualistic dimension, the choice dimension, there might be a lot of social science discussions about is choice really real and does exit really happen and all of that. Those debates need to go on. But I think ultimately, self-definition and exit need to be there in order for us to still recognize these claims as human rights claims.
I see two questions. So given the time, maybe we could just take them back to back and then invite one more response before we go on to the next session.
Hi, I'm Tom Trotton from McGill. You identified sort of three aspects that objectively determine what a minority right a minority is: numerically inferior, not dominant, and has solidarity. So I'm wondering if you could just speak a little bit to the difficulties of identifying minorities with minorities, and do they constitute separate minorities? Because, you know, when we talk about Buddhism and say, oh, Buddhism might be numerically inferior, but it's possible to consider Buddhism might be dominant and not dominant. And so how objectively are you going to determine that?
Thanks. I just wanted to get you to unpack the whole state question a bit more, because I think you obviously very questionable of this whole state, the question. And what my feeling is that a lot of the time, where you find minorities, states have often been imposed in the first place. So there's a minority doesn't think of itself as a minority, say in Africa, because actually within the region it's a much larger group, and so you find it difficult to get them to think of themselves within the state as a minority. And then this brings in, how do you get them to gain the benefits of being a minority if they're not going to classify themselves as a minority? And I just wanted to see if you could kind of expand on how much more, because I mean, we're just about to start working in Nigeria, which is obviously massively relevant in that sense. And how could you go about making a group realize that it's a minority without then giving it the kind of degrading it in the way that you described. Thank you.
Wow. I mean, I think these are questions we should ponder for decades to come. I know that the indigenous definition runs into problems in the African continent in particular, but you're right that the minority problem does as well. I think we shouldn't... History is a powerful thing, and many of the minority dilemmas or pluralism dilemmas we face may come from colonialism and straight lines and hastily created nation states. But in human rights, it's easier just to take things as given now and say that these square states voluntarily signed up to these legal commitments, and regardless of their history, I mean, whether they want to open boundary questions and all of that is for them to decide and their populations to be consulted, etc. But regardless of that, I don't want to give historical and imperialistic excuses to governments regarding legal commitments they have entered, and which, after all, are very minimum. They're very minimal. I would hope that many societies can go far beyond these minimal criteria. Why should a state or a community need to be told that legally you are required to allow for effective participation of everybody in your society? That should just be a natural mode of operation. Yes, so I'm not sort of fully going there, but I agree with you that it is problematic. Certainly, we shouldn't. This is regarding both questions. No persons belonging to minorities should be obliged to declare themselves religious minorities. But at the international level, we are recognizing characteristics that seem to fit the bill. Okay. When it comes to sort of splinter groups or offshoots of different religions, then not only do we have self-definition by the persons concerned, we also have their freedom of religion or belief. And there's nothing in international human rights law that stops you from declaring a new religion or belief. I mean, international human rights law doesn't have a position on that, nor will it restrict that unless it infringes on the definite rights and freedoms of others, not some kind of offense to their worldview. So, and part of religion or belief would also become interpretation of religion or belief, and that's a perpetual right that everybody, regardless of what religion or belief they hold, can perpetually interpret and understand the provisions of their texts or beliefs as they wish. So we are not objectively determining as outside actors. There are persons, they show solidarity regarding characteristics they want to maintain. They may, a part of that may be that they've declared a new religion or a new belief system within a particular existing religion, and they have the solidarity and characteristics that they want to maintain, and then minority rights come to bear, okay, in addition to all other human rights that they should benefit from. Sorry, I can't answer these questions in two minutes, but I think all that the human rights regime gives us is the minimum standards. It gives us certain characteristics and factors to look out for. And beyond that, there is a lot of complexity. Okay. But there are some tools that may add to the other tools that we have in the toolbox regarding how to pursue claims.
Well, please join me in thanking Dr. Ghani for an insightful and illuminating talk.